General Boykin, our audience is familiar with your resume, but let's catch up with some of your thoughts on issues that have gone on lately in our world. Number one, there's a move to build a mosque, as you know, in the vicinity of Ground Zero in New York City. When you first heard that, what was your gut reaction?
Extraordinary disappointment. And I'm disappointed, Skip, that so many people have so little understanding of the significance of building that mosque there. You know, Skip, when Muhammad led his army back to Mecca and defeated and subjugated the nomadic tribes there, he built his mosque on the Kaaba, or the most holy site. When they defeated the Jews in Jerusalem and they took over the city of Jerusalem, where did they build their mosque?
Yeah.
The most holy site.
Yep.
Now that they've brought down our towers, they will erect a mosque to give a very clear message, just as they did in Mecca and Jerusalem, that Islam reigns supreme. I am so disappointed in the lack of understanding of the people in New York who voted for this overwhelmingly, 29-1, and I was in New York when it happened, Skip. And I'm grieved over it, and I'm grieved even more by the fact that there were Christian pastors and rabbis that supported the Islamic groups there that are building this with, by the way, foreign money from the Gulf states and other Islamic countries. So I'm really grieved over it.
Well, you mentioned something significant, our lack of understanding. And I just would like you to fill in some of the blind spots that we don't see. What is the lack of understanding when it comes to Islam or building a mosque or the freedom of religion, so-called, all of that that is done in the name of it? What are we not seeing? What part of the picture?
What we're not seeing, first and foremost, is the fact that Islam is not a religion. It's a totalitarian way of life. There is a religious component, but we still treat it as a First Amendment issue when, in fact, it is a totalitarian way of life. And when you think Islam, you need to think Sharia law. Mm-hmm. Sharia law is the law that subjugates women, that cuts off the hand of the thief, that beheads the adulteress. That's Sharia law, and that is what Islam is. It is a legal system more than anything else with a religious component, and people simply do not understand that, and consequently, Skip, we still treat it as a First Amendment issue.
So are you telling me that that is their ultimate intent, is to establish Sharia law here?
Unquestionably, they have told us that. They have said that. They have made it very clear what their intentions are, that this will become an Islamic republic living under Sharia law. Mm-hmm. And we have essentially ignored their warnings about what they intend for America.
Well, let's talk about a prior Muslim, somebody that you and I both know, and that's Mossab Hassan Youssef. For our audience's sake, he was the son of Hamas, so-called, the Green Prince, son of one of the founders of Hamas, slated something to take over that organization. And he defected from Islam eventually, worked with Israeli counterintelligence. And there's talk, since he's in our country right now in the United States, and as a powerful testimony, there's talk of deporting him. What are your thoughts about that? What's your reaction?
My thoughts are that we have 11 to 12 million illegal immigrants in this country that we have not only made no effort to send home, but we, in fact, have provided a great deal of support for them. And now we have this this man who is an overt Christian who has spoken out against the most dangerous threat America's faced since 1776. And we want to deport him. You tell me why, and the reason is clearly because we do not want to offend nor rile the Islamic jihadist.
I want you just to press that a little bit further, because what we're being told by the government is him staying here presents us with a problem. So how would you respond to that?
Well, I don't think anybody has adequately defined what problem that is. Mm-hmm. You know, the problem is perceived by the people who are making this decision is that we are in some way causing frustrations among the very people that want to destroy us. The idea that we will rile the Islamic jihadist, I think, is at the base of this. Mm-hmm. And clearly, he has spoken out in uncensored terms about what Islam is and the danger that it presents, just as others have. Mm-hmm. But of course, he is probably the most credible.
Yes.
And as a result of that, you know, we're making a terrible decision to send this man to what I believe is going to be certain death the moment he is outside the United States, where he no longer has the protection. He's a dead man.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we don't want to offend nor rile the passions of the jihadist. We would rather let him go back and be killed, and I find that just offensive and unacceptable as an American.
Mm-hmm. So do you see this whole move to get him out of the country as sort of a political sacrificial lamb? Just is the thought to quiet down the enemies of America?
Well, I think it is. I think it's not so much to quiet them down. I think that there are people in our administration that understand they're not going to quiet them down, but I think it's an effort in some way not to increase their activities and their angst with us.
Mm-hmm. General, back to something you just mentioned about illegal immigration, and it brought up another issue. That you said we have all of these illegal immigrants in our country, and here's somebody who is legally in our country, and we want to deport him. How does that interface with the porous borders that we have in America? I'd like to get your take on, for instance, the crackdown in Arizona to seal up the borders and illegal immigrants from coming over. How potential of a problem is that for radical Islam coming in here?
Well, there is no question, and you can find it on websites. There's a category of people coming into the United States called other than Mexicans, and they include people out of Islamic countries, and there's a record of the number that we've actually caught. And, of course, we don't know what we haven't caught, but you can find that on a government website that will show you the number of people from the Middle East that are coming in. Now, Skip, I just was notified by some folks in Southern California that the leading group of Muslim converts now are Hispanics who have been duped into believing that their Catholic faith is that Islam is an extension of their Catholic faith. And then I was told by some very credible sources that the same thing is occurring down in Mexico, where entire villages are being converted to Islam. Now think about the impact of having people that are Muslim converts on the south side of the border and people on the north side of the border working together. They can bring anything into this country, and they are doing it right now, Skip.
And of course, once again, that's part of that news story that we don't hear in this country. Nobody's reporting what you just said.
Well, that's right, and it's an election year.
Mm-hmm.
And politicians are very squeamish about getting involved in the discussion on this.
Well, I want to jump into another issue. Because of your background, there's a lot of these headlines that your insight in is invaluable. There's been international outcry against Israel's supposed harsh response to a flotilla that was as close to its coast, the coast with Gaza, and that flotilla was carrying weapons, supposedly. What's your perspective on this event? Did Israel overreact? Was it the right reaction?
No, Skip, first of all, I don't know that they've proven that there were weapons on that, but it's irrelevant. Israel, under international law, has declared a blockade of Gaza. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but it is legal for them to do that. And as long as they notify internationally, they notify other nations of the boundaries of that blockade, it's legal. The group that brought that ship in is associated with terrorist organizations in Turkey. And, Skip, I can't prove this, but I would tell you that I believe There are members of the Turkish government that are involved in this and that helped make the decision. It was designed to provoke the Israelis. It was designed to do exactly what it did.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I was very disappointed in the Israelis and how they executed this. Now, you know, you can say you can go after 10 ships and there's no problems, and you go after the 11th one and you get in a gunfight. Well, but they should have been prepared, and going in with paintball is not the Israeli military that I've worked with in the past, and it is not representative of what I believe Prime Minister Netanyahu's general outlook on things is. So I think it was poorly executed, and I think somebody's going to be disciplined for that.
Mm. And so at this point, it's sort of a PR war, isn't it?
It's exactly right. And the fact of the matter is, other nations know that Israel was perfectly within their legal rights. But it just gives them another opportunity to criticize Israel, and Skip, it comes back to something very fundamental here as we talk about this. It's not just the hatred of Israel. It's also the dependence of the rest of the world on that Middle East, Persian Gulf oil, and not wanting to risk losing the supply of oil there.
Wow. General, since you've retired, you're probably busier than you ever were, because I know I've been at conferences where you have spoken from Jerusalem to New Mexico to California, and you speak a lot, and you travel a lot. And so I want to know, since you've done that, what is the level of interest and concern that you find about radical Islam when you travel?
I find that there are more and more people now that are starting to say, okay, what's the government not telling us? What do we not understand about this? There is also a large cohort in our nation who they do not want to know the truth, and they deliberately bury their head in the sand and continue to say, well, you know, most of these people are peaceful. Well, that's true. Most of them are. But the question we have to ask is, and where are they when 13 people are killed at Fort Hood? Or someone tries to blow up a plane over Detroit, where are these people that are so peaceful? And the answer is either they support what's going on, or they are so afraid and intimidated that they won't speak out. And remember, in 1917, only 3% of Russia was communist, and in 1924, only 3% of Germany was a Nazi. But they both had brutal, committed leadership that was willing to do whatever they had to do to bring the rest along. And that's the problem we have with the jihadists. They can bring the rest along. In fact, I think you know probably that in London itself, 10 years ago, only about 17% of the people believed that jihad was an acceptable form of warfare within Islam. And today, among the Islamic population there, it is well over 50%. That's what we need to be concerned about in America.
Wow. Okay, so I guess the follow-up question that I would have is, we have this sense, we have this mistrust in our own government and in the media telling us the whole truth. So there seems to be this awakening on one hand among people who want to find out the real issue of this. So tell us, what do we do about it? I mean, the average American feels sort of helpless. What can we proactively do, given the fact that that's what's on our landscape with Islam?
Well, I think there are a couple of things we can do, Skip. We would start with praying for an awakening in our nation, a spiritual awakening, and that will draw us to an understanding of the dangers of Islam. The second thing is just exactly what you and a number of your colleagues in the Calvary Chapel have done, and that is bring people in to speak to audiences about the realities of Islam and what they're trying to do in this country. The third thing is we can really let our representatives, those we've elected to represent us in Washington and at the state and local level, let them know how concerned we are. We need to be bombarding them. We need to mass our resources and just bombard them with calls and letters and emails and visits and let them know that we want accountability on this issue of the growing danger of Islam. And we've got to get active. We can no longer sit on the sidelines on this, especially as the body of Christ.
Mm. You just mentioned something a couple moments ago about the growing intensity of Islam in London, in Great Britain. And we're seeing a part of that in the United States as well. I mean, I think we sort of follow in their footsteps about 10 or 15 years. There seems to be, both here and in England and even other European countries, this trending away from mentioning the word terrorism or using the term radical Islam or, as you do, jihadist. And in so doing, it seems to be veiling the threat. It certainly doesn't take the threat away. What is that doing when you communicate that way and you don't call it what it is? What is that doing to the sensitivity of the population?
Well, you know, you make a great point. John Brennan, who is President Obama's senior terrorism advisor, has made the statement that we are not going to call them jihadists because jihad is a internal struggle and all we're doing is giving legitimacy to these thugs. Well, the reality is John Brennan doesn't know the first thing about Islam because the scholars within Islam have said for centuries that jihad is holy war against infidels. So when we refuse to recognize that it is holy war against infidels, we are denying the reality of our enemy. And we continue to categorize them as extremists or radicals or people who are not following the dictates of Islam. Well, the reality is they are following the dictates of Islam, and all we're doing is playing their game of propaganda when we refuse to acknowledge that they are terrorists, they're jihadists, they're Muslims, they are Islamists, and they want to destroy our Constitution and replace it with Sharia law.
Hmm. I want you to give some comment on the wars that we're currently involved in overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. What is your view of the value of these conflicts for America? A lot of people would say, why should we be involved overseas? I mean, that's so far away. What right do Americans have to get involved in that political and military landscape?
It is a question that Americans should be asking. Now, my answer to that is, in the case of Afghanistan, we need to remember that that is where the 9/11 attacks were planned and launched from. And should we leave Afghanistan before there is some kind of stable environment there where they can defend their borders as well as defend themselves internally against Al-Qaeda and its associates, the Taliban? All that's going to happen is they're going to come back in there and reestablish their strongholds, and we're going to have to go back and deal with the same group again. So I think it is essential that we have to win there. We have no alternative. The second thing is with Iraq, I think we need to remember that Iraq, even though we did not find what the national intelligence estimate said, Iraq did have weapons of mass destruction, and there is substantial evidence that we did find weapons of mass destruction, and I saw them myself. Even though it was not what was in the national intelligence estimate, it was there. And the idea there was to deny Saddam Hussein the opportunity to use those against his neighbors or to become so powerful as a result of the threat that he presented that he would have substantial control over the Persian Gulf. So I think that at this stage, we need to remember that if we come out of Iraq, without having secured some kind of victory there, that the recruiting to the jihadist cause will go off the scale because the jihadist will say, Allah has shown us favor, we've defeated the infidels, and just as it was in when the Russians left Afghanistan in 89, the recruiting to their cause will go off the scale, and that is not good.
In your opinion, should we have gone into Iraq in the first place?
Well, Skip, I was on the border. I really was on the border on that issue when it. I was not convinced that we needed to go in there, and quite frankly, in private sessions, I stated that. Having said that, and having seen now what I have seen, I believe that we were right to go in there. I don't think we conducted ourselves appropriately. I don't think we fought this thing the way we should have until we got Dave Petraeus in. I think we went in with too little, and I think that we made some tactical and operational mistakes in how we approached it. But I believe that it was the right thing to do, and I believe we have to win.
I want to throw you a curveball, General Boykin. If you look back historically, the history of the church, and I use that very broadly in Christendom, we had a series of crusades, at least Europe did, where we waged a holy war against those in the Middle East, Jews and Muslims. And I think probably academics or Muslims especially would say, well, you know, you guys can't point the finger at us. You have been guilty of the same in your past. Is there a similarity, or is it vastly different?
Well, first of all, I think we need to separate the cause for the jihad, for the crusades, versus what the crusaders themselves did. The reason for the crusades was to protect the Christian enclaves. Plain and simple, there was no expansion as part of the strategy there. It was protecting the Christian enclaves. Now, the crusaders did some terrible things, not just to Muslims, but they did some terrible things to the Jews, and I think that's the most despicable part of the crusades, is what they wound up doing to the Jews in different places. Mm-hmm. But look, let's go back and say, okay, that's history. We live for today. We live for the future. What are we going to do now?
Mm-hmm.
You cannot justify jihad. You cannot justify the establishment of a caliphate by force,
mm-hmm.
Based on the Crusades, and that is what so many want to do. They want to use that as an argument.
Mm.
The concept of the Crusades was a noble concept, but there were some bad things that happened.
Yes. I want you to just sort of close out our interview together with something I've been excited about as I've heard you the past several years. We've had you out to speak to men, and I know that you've traveled around the country, around the world, speaking directly to men about the need to be spiritual warriors. So if you don't mind, would you address the men in our audience on the subject?
Yeah, I would. Thanks for the opportunity. Skip, there are so many in the church today that who are just they're waiting for the rapture. They're waiting for Jesus to come, and they do not recognize that what God expects of us is for us to be warriors in His kingdom, to continue to build His kingdom, to continue to fight as warriors in His kingdom until He does return. And shame on those people who are content to just sit on the pews of the church. That's important. You learn there, but you take what you learn from the church and from the spiritual leaders, and you take that and you get back out on the battlefield. And the battlefield for us right now is right here on the streets of America. And, men have to take the lead. Men are, Exodus 15:3 says, the Lord is a warrior. The Lord is His name. Why did they use the term warrior? It's because that's exactly what God is. And when Jesus returns, He will come back as a warrior. And, Skip, every single one of us has to be exactly the same thing until He returns.
Hmm. Great word. You did a great job on your book, Never Surrender. I just want to tell our audience, I recommend that book highly. It's a great read. It's riveting. All the things you have been involved in, B, that you survived so many of those things, and C, that the Lord has given you a platform to use your own personal history as an encouragement to men and women to get involved in the real battle. General Boykin, thank you so much for being with us. God bless you and your ministry.
Skip, thank you, and thanks for your boldness and for what you are doing to build the kingdom of God. May the Lord bless you.
Thank you, sir. God bless.